Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzno, we examine monster legends and the facts behind them. Today, we're discussing a monster known as the Popobawa, a giant, bat-winged, shape-changing, magical creature that allegedly terrorizes the people of Zanzibar. The way the Popobawa attacks means that this episode is going to be getting the explicit tag. So if you've got the kids, huddle around the podcast player. This episode's probably not the one to listen to.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
I've had a couple of people ask, what's happened to the show and when are you going to put out a new episode? Someone asked on Facebook tonight, and I said, well, actually, we're going to be recording one tonight.
Why aren't I getting my weekly updates?
Exactly. Right. So, well, I want to get back to that, but
okay.
Swear everybody I want to talk to has gone on vacation. Okay. So I had an episode lined up for Mermaids. And the guy couldn't, I couldn't get everything quite coordinated for this weekend. So I'm like, okay, well, let's just do it later. He goes, well, there's a bit of a problem. I'm going on a camper trip. I'm like, okay, well, when you get back? He goes, I'll be back in about 3 months. I'm like, ooh, crap. Because he's like, he said he was going on a camping trip with his camper, like taking a RV and driving around the country or whatever. And then after that, he's in Vietnam or something. Like, so he's really, it's going to be a while. I'm probably going to have to find a different guest to talk about that. But we do want to do an episode on mermaids because we need to respond to Animal Planet's pseudo-documentary.
Yes.
Or, I mean, I was going to say, I don't think we need to wait 3 months. I mean, if we can always, do something that specifically addresses the Animal Planet thing, and then we can revisit it later on.
So I think there are two shows in that, definitely.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, right, because there's one kind of mermaid that's like fish on the bottom, and there's another kind of mermaid that's fish on the top.
That's right. That's right.
Gotta cover both.
Yeah, we'll work on that.
Good.
All right. So, tonight we're going to talk about a monster that's not actually very well known in the United States. And it's also a fairly new monster. I mean, would it be wrong to kind of call this the... the Africa Chupacabra, in a sense, the way it just sort of sprang out of nowhere?
That's not too far off, actually. There are some interesting parallels between the Chupacabra and the Popobawa. There are some significant differences, but in some ways they're sort of similar in that way, yeah.
So we're going to be talking about this monster called the Popobawa. That's Popobawa. Popobawa. Okay.
Does that mean?
It means bat wing, which is also the name of the aircraft that Batman flies in the new Batman movie. Spoiler alert.
Although, other than that, there's no connection whatsoever. Thanks, Blake.
So Ben,
what is it?
What is the Popobawa? And
what is this odd Popobawa thing you speak of? Yes, you're exactly right. Popobawa means bat wing in Kiswahili, and it's named for the shape of the shadow it casts when it swoops down. It's supposed to cast the shadow of a bat, and it's this sort of weird East African monster creature thing, and it's variously thought to be a demon or an evil spirit. A genie sent by witches, a bat demon, an ogre, a sexually voracious ghost along the lines of a succubus or incubus, things like that. And so it actually comes in a whole lot of different forms, which is sort of one of the interesting things about it. I first heard about it in 1995. I was reading a newspaper called the Bolivian Times. And in fact, I have the clipping right here, and it says, "The evil spirit that rapes men in Zanzibar." And the tagline was, "Maybe it will attack anybody who doesn't know better." It was actually reprinted from The Guardian, which is not known as a bastion of great journalism, I should add. But it just had this page long story about this evil, weird spirit in Zanzibar. And as it happened, when I read this story, I was actually, little did I know, I would actually be in Zanzibar several months later. And so I sort of took the opportunity to do some research on it while I was there anyway.
Has it been spotted in other countries as well?
Yes, primarily. For those who don't know, Zanzibar is it's a small island off the coast of Tanzania in East Africa. It's sort of south of Kenya and north of Mozambique and Madagascar. And Zanzibar itself is actually composed of two different islands. There's the larger island of Zanzibar, and there's a smaller island called Pemba. Pemba is sort of the smaller, less economically viable island of the two, and there's a reason why I bothered to mention that, and I'll come to that later. But basically, it's primarily seen and reported in Zanzibar, but also in Tanzania, primarily Dar es Salaam, which is the capital of Tanzania, and a little bit in Kenya. But it's interesting because it's primarily limited just to those areas. I mean, for example, in my research, I didn't find any reports of Popobawa in northern Africa or South America or anywhere else in the world. It's very, very localized to that region.
Have a lot of bats in Zanzibar?
There are quite a few bats in Zanzibar. None of them are anywhere near man size. The thing about it what's interesting is that there was very little serious critical analysis or investigation when I looked into it. There were really only one or two articles and almost nothing that was scholarly. So when I was research, I looked in like folklore journals and places like that. But in terms of like the, for example, I've got as most of us do, we have a shelf of cryptozoology books. And even in those, there was often only a few paragraphs. And so that was one of the things that really made it intriguing for me to look into, was that there was such a dearth of information. And again, this sort of goes back to similarities with the Chupacabra investigation, where, there was a little bit written on it, but really very little that was critical or scholarly or academic. And so it was sort of a fresh, fertile field to look into.
You know, it's funny. I was talking with Brian Dunning from the Skeptoid podcast about this very thing just earlier, maybe last week. He was looking for more information on skinwalkers for an episode he rolled out this week. It's hard to find scholarly research on skinwalkers. Lots of great skinwalker scary stories, but there's just not a lot of. There's so many monsters out there that are part of folklore, but that really haven't been treated seriously in a skeptical or scientific way. So
you're right. Perhaps Brian should check out the Skeptical Briefs newsletter. I have a columnist. One of my columns there is a friend of mine called Noah Nez, and he writes the column called Native Skeptic. And it's sort of skepticism from Native American point of view. In fact, I think an issue or two ago, he did a whole column on skinwalkers.
Cool.
Maybe
Brian should have called you instead of me.
Brian should have called me, or maybe he should read
Skeptical Briefs. Yeah. How would someone find Skeptical Briefs, Ben?
Funny you should ask. You actually have to be a member of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry to get the newsletter. But it's a very good newsletter. I'm the editor of it.
Some of the pieces appear online occasionally as well.
Yes, that's true as well. So, anyway, on the Popobawa. So again, we have this weird, evil demon bat thing, and really the first reports of it only date back to about 1965. There was one main report in 1965 on the island of Pemba that I mentioned earlier. And there were a few in 1970s, 1980s. There was a huge flap. So it sounds like one of your gags. There was a huge Popobawa flap in 1995. I thought you'd like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And it was basically just causing all sorts of hysteria. And people were so scared of this creature, this bat demon thing, that many people refused to sleep alone in their beds.
Yeah, I think I've heard that.
They weren't before. Alone, were they?
They weren't alone, yes. Well, there are various ways of warding off the bubble baba. One of them, one of the remedies is well, I guess you'd call it prophylactic, is pig oil. So if you have oil from pigs, that's supposed to keep them away.
Would bacon fat work? I mean, is it the same thing? Because I'm okay then. I'm usually at least halfway coated with bacon fat.
I think you're safe there, Blake. I wouldn't worry too much about it. But one of them is pig oil. Another one is staying awake, which is interesting because that, to my mind, that ties in with some of the stories about, for example, vampires, or even the Freddy Krueger thing. You know, the idea that in your dreams this evil entity will attack you, and therefore the way to keep it at bay is to stay awake and try and struggle through the night to the next day. Another way
sounds like it's a product of sleep paralysis.
Well, that's certainly one of the explanations, and I'll touch on that. Another way is to sleep somewhere other than your own bed. It's often believed that the popobawa specifically targets people in their own beds, and so during the height of the 1985 popobawa scare, many villagers throughout Zanzibar would actually would stay out in the woods and even like along the highways. Which is a problem because there's not very much lighting along the highways, and so you would actually have, unlit tarmac roads, where there's no lights at all. People are sleeping next to the roads because they think it's safer there, and I don't have any records. Exactly. So that's not uncommon. And there I did read some reports.
They were really sleepy, and then later they got tired.
Tired. T-Y-R-E-D, yes. There were also some reports that there was a mentally disturbed man that admitted to being the popobawa who was then lynched. So this is one of the things where, the ideas that are floating around in the culture and society, if a person, as we skeptics know, people can and do admit to crimes they didn't commit, and obviously that's certainly happened before. Yeah,
the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Right. The creepy guy that mm-hmm. admitted that he killed her, and it turns out he didn't.
How
many Jack the Rippers were there?
The perfect example. Exactly, Karen. I mean, there was, I off the top of my head, I can think of at least four or five people that claimed that they were the Ripper, and there may be many
more. And then
more.
There were all those people who did similar crimes in other places and get kind of credit, the Jack the Ripoffs.
Jack the Ripoff.
Well, they're
on fire tonight.
Wow. So the question then becomes, well, what do they think that it does? I mean, you can have this evil demon spirit bat thing flying around, but so what? Well, the answer is that it's supposed to claw people, scratch them, but primarily it's supposed to rape them. That's one of its main attacks. The popobawa also supposedly has linguistic capabilities, and it can talk or communicate Ooh. Telepathically. So it's sort of the more you learn about it, the more it's sort of intriguing it gets. And one of the main things that it communicates is it tells its victims that if it doesn't tell other people that they've been attacked by the popobawa, it will repeat it the next night. So I mean,
likes its notoriety.
So you have, like, once you've been victimized, it wants you to tell people that you've been victimized, or else it will keep repeating the crime.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or I don't know if it's a crime if a monster rapes you, because it's not like it's a person, but...
Well, yeah, I'm not sure what the... I think it depends.
I'm not trying to be silly when I'm about to ask. I mean, was the creature derived... Like, was it stealing energy or, like, blood? Or, like, in what way does it benefit the popobawa to sodomize its victims?
Fine. Well... The main reason that I came up with in my research was that one thing you have to remember about Zanzibar specifically and actually East Africa generally is that it's largely Muslim, and as with many monsters, it's important to look at the sociocultural aspect and the you know, these creatures don't occur in a vacuum. I mean, that was also, again, the case very much with the Chupacabra, as we know. I mean, the Chupacabra was very much a product of a specific time and place, you know, 1995, Puerto Rico and all the things like that. And in the Popobawa is also very much the same way. And so, as far as I can tell, the main reason that there's that whole whole sodomizing raping aspect is that in Muslim cultures, homosexuality is taboo, particularly male homosexuality, and so for many Muslim men, the idea of being raped, anally raped by anything, much less an evil, large penised bat demon thing, is horrific. I mean, it's really sort of the ultimate, humiliation and humiliating masculine in terms of masculinity, but also in terms of being a Muslim. So this is really a base violation, and I think that that's where the Popo derives its power. It doesn't just slap you around, it doesn't just take your money. It violates you in a very, very specific, brutal way. And again, it threatens to do it again if you don't tell other people. And so that's one of the interesting aspects to it, is that that's how sort of the way that it perpetuates itself in terms of a story. For example, if you look at folklore in terms of urban legends, one of the reasons why urban legends are so popular is that urban legends often have a twist at the end, or sort of a moral to the story, or something that's humorous or interesting or funny or whatever else, or intriguing. And that little tag at the end, that element to it, is the reason why we pass it along, why we tell other people, why we hear about them, you know, the surprise twist ending, you know, the hand-hooked killer, you know, the spiders.
And dogs are not the only animals that lick.
Dogs aren't the only animals that lick. You know, call 911, your kidney is gone. There's all these. So if you look at the types of stories and in terms of folklore that are repeated and continued on, and the sorts of stories that are repeated and have a life of their own, they have, you know, an element of that. And so I think that's one of the interesting reasons why the Popobawa story is so prevalent, certainly in East Africa, is that it has this it has this internal mechanism by which if you don't tell people that you were a victim, it'll happen again. And of course, its victims are sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, no Muslim man wants to admit that it was attacked by the Popobawa and raped. On the other hand, if you're scared it's going to happen again, and you're being threatened to tell people, then there's a certain social, you know, mechanism there.
As with Bigfoot, there are people who come forward and say that they have evidence that they've taken photographs, albeit blurry, or video of Bigfoot. Is there anything like that for the Popobawa?
Excellent question. The answer is no.
Never.
Not at all. There's no photographs of it. There are a handful of drawings and sketches. Actually, one of them, when I did my investigation, I could talk a little bit about what I did a little bit later, but part of my investigation was tracking down a person in Zanzibar who believed in the Popobawa, an artist actually, and I asked him to draw for me or paint for me his depiction of a Popobawa. In fact, if people are interested, we can have that photo in the show notes, that image in the show notes.
That'd be great.
Yeah, and so it's kind of interesting. Sort of, you know, I said, you know, you believe in this? He said, absolutely. I said, what do you think it looks like? And he sort of hemmed and hawed. And one thing you have to understand about the Popobawa, because it comes in so many different forms, some people say that talking about its description is meaningless because either, well, there's a couple reasons they give. One is that it's invisible. It literally has no form. And therefore, anybody that thinks that they saw, you know, a giant bat or a one-eyed dwarf or, you know, or a large ogre with a massive cock, whatever they think that they saw, that is by definition a mistake or a hallucination, because the Popobawa is inherently imperceivable, it's invisible. Other people believe that it's more of like a chameleon, that's, you know, it's sort of like, you know, what shape is, you know, God? Well, presumably, if you know, it could appear as a tree or a horse or a snake, or basically. So in that regard, some people say that talking about what the Popo Vahua looks like is based on a faulty premise, because the Popo Vahua can be anything because it's supernatural.
Well, that makes me want to ask another question, if you don't mind, Blake. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, do you think there are any cases where this is used as an excuse to cover rape or molestation or something, that people blame this faceless creature?
Another good question. I don't think so. It's possible at some point. And the main reason I don't think so is because the perception of the Popo Vahua is invariably supernatural. It's, you know, they have a very specific idea of what it is that attacked them, and it's not another man, it's not a woman, it's nothing human. It is inherently supernatural, and that actually goes back to your previous question about whether when we talk about cryptozoological creatures and these monsters and things, there are alleged photographs, as we all know, of the Loch Ness Monster and Nessie and Champ and Bigfoot and Chupacabra for else. But again, there's nothing like that for the Popo Vahua. And that's because people just have this wide variety of ideas about what it is. And so it can sort of basically be anything. And that's all the more reason why it's sort of difficult to sort of track down and sort of specify exactly what you're looking for. I'll just as a rejoinder, one of the few sources that I found that was even quasi-credible was my old nemesis, Josh Gates, on Destination Truth. Yeah, thank you. One of them. And good old Josh went to Zanzibar after I'd done so. And he did a show there. It aired, I think, March 26th, 2008. And he began,
specific.
Well, I have it right here. It was sometime around March 26th at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. give or take.
Did he find the truth?
No. Oh. It was a typical destination.
That's his destination.
Didn't he steal your work?
He hasn't gotten there yet. He's still traveling.
Yeah, maybe you should pick up a copy of my... Anyway, so yeah, so Gates begins...
It should be called Destination Predetermined.
Oh, I like that. I like that. And it's not the truth. Yeah. I won't bother to deconstruct the episode, but basically they began by looking for what, this is a quote from the episode, an enormous bat-like creature with a single eye that emits light. And so they began by looking for a giant bat over the city of Zanzibar, which is ridiculous. I mean,
I'm a big fan of evolution, and it can do some amazing things, but why would the bioluminescence emit from the eye? That's weird. Yeah,
that is weird. That's what it was. And when I'm looking at this, I'm seeing him the first 10 minutes are like this really cheesy, Ghost Hunters esque, like, oh my God, what was that? It's like, yeah, that's nothing. It's the wind. So for reasons, I either have to assume that Gates didn't do his research and didn't have a clue as to what the Popo Vahua actually was. Otherwise, he wouldn't be looking for an enormous bat-like creature. Or more likely, frankly, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, the producers needed to show something interesting. And they knew from the get-go that that wasn't really what they were looking for. It was a red herring. But they thought it would be dramatic if they had him running from rooftop to rooftop in Stone Town, which is the main town, Zanzibar, looking for this thing. So
it sounds like Spring-Heeled Jack a bit, too.
Well, that's exactly right, and I'm glad you brought that up, because the Popo Vahua really fits very well in terms of when you look at the context of other nighttime attacking creatures. Spring-Heeled Jack, as you pointed out, is a perfect example.
And the Monkey Man of Delhi also came to mind.
Right, exactly. The Delhi Monkey Man, which was this creature that was bounding from rooftop to rooftop in Delhi a few years ago.
Or was it?
Oh, Dun, 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 dun.
Join us on Destination Predetermined to find out that, yes, it probably was.
That's what I think, yes. Yeah. And but, I mean, so there's Spring-Heeled Jack and Monkey Man. There's also the Phantom Slasher of Taipei for the mass hysteria fans in the audience. And the Orang Maniac, the Oily Man, I wrote about, I think this was earlier.
Look,
this year.
I told you it was bacon fat. It was bacon fat.
but in all these cases, you have this. It's basically variations on a theme where you have some only generally sketched out. You have some rough ideas of what it might be. It's something that attacks very quickly. It never kills anybody. It just sort of leaves some wounds and scared victims primarily, and is said to sort of leap off into the darkness, attacking primarily at night. So again, the Popobawa, like many of these creatures. And in fact, now that I think about it, in many ways, also the chupacabra. I mean, most chupacabra reports, deal with things that happen overnight. It's basically a nighttime predatory creature. A farmer wakes up in the morning and sees allegedly, bloodless dogs or goats or whatever else. And the assumption is that during the cover of night, this creature came in and did that. So it fits very much within that context.
I find interesting about the cryptozoology field and just monsters and legends and folklore in general is there's this recurring phrase that people say, which is that every legend has a kernel of truth inside. And I think that's probably exactly the opposite of how skeptical investigations should approach such topics. I think we probably should always start with, is there any truth to this at all? Did anything even happen? So, and I'm assuming that's probably the tack you took on it, Ben.
Yeah. I mean, it was the first thing I was trying to figure out, was trying to, wrap my mind around it was, and just to back up a second to Karen's earlier question, it's the Popobawa is nearly unique in that, unlike, for example, Chupacabra, Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, things like that, it's a singular creature. The Popobawa is the singular Popobawa. It's not thought of it as a race of creatures. It's not more than one. It's one single specific.
He's like identifiable. Santa.
Exactly, the Popobawa Santa. And so, as I was doing the research on this, it became clearer and clearer to me that there were three different ideas of what it was before I looked into it. One of them was that it's some sort of real creature, and this is sort of almost the premise that Josh Gates, in his misguided efforts to look at the Popobawa, began with, was it's a real creature that maybe misperceived. Maybe it's some sort of variation of some giant bat that was just sort of misunderstood. How exactly you could work in the anal raping is a bit beyond me, but whatever. Other people believed that it was a magical creature, just inherently. And again, that sort of touches on what I was talking about earlier, that it's sort of not confined to the bounds of our normal, flesh and blood cryptozoological creatures. And the third explanation was basically that it was all a hallucination. It was all basically a misunderstanding or whatever else. And so... when I was approaching the topic, I needed to try and figure out, what the hell am I dealing with here? And it quickly became clear that it could not be a real flesh and blood creature. There was too many variations there, at least even within, within, for example, Bigfoot or Chupacabra, there's quite a bit of variation, but it's not everything from, a one-eyed, flying bat demon to an ogre to a genie to this and that. I mean, there's some parameters here. And plus, of course, you also have the element of the sodomy. I've always wanted to say the phrase, you always have the element of the sodomy. There you go. You have to keep that in.
Think it's sexual assault and giant battery.
Yeah, giant battery. Oh, I get it. That was clever. But you don't really see that as much. And also, for example, if nothing else, the claim that the Popobawa speaks to people telepathically or using language. Mm-hmm. Again, this is, it's self-evidently not a real creature. And so at that point, the question then became, what the hell is it? What do people think it is? And so that's when I began doing more research into the culture of it. And so when I went to Zanzibar, I contacted local people and I had translators. I don't speak Kiswahili, and so other than can I get a beer and danger elephant, which isn't really useful because there's no elephants in Zanzibar. So that was
danger Papa Bawa.
There you go. I'll have to work on that. But so I basically had some local informants that I was working with. And so I tried to sort of get them to tell me, what do you think the Popo Bawa is? And by far the most popular explanation was that it was a genie. It was a genie that had basically escaped from its master and gotten away. And again, you see... it's important to realize that in Africa generally, and specifically in East Africa, there's very, very strong belief in witchcraft and magic and things like this. And I've written about before, for example, horrific stories of albinos, men, women, and children having their limbs cut off and hacked off in Muti murders. There are many people in throughout sub-Saharan Africa who really believe that magic works, and in order to cast spells and protection and attacks, you need body parts. And so it's sort of easy for sort of Westerners to sort of, oh, this is all silly, nobody believes in witchcraft. No, this is particularly in East Africa, many people absolutely believe witchcraft, and it's important to understand that in the context of the chupacabra. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, it's really interesting because Africa is so big. I mean, people really don't realize how big Africa is. And we really can't talk about it in terms of like a giant uniform thing. Like, it's not like the United States. Right. And each country is its own thing. But yet it is a consistent thing across this gigantic continent that witchcraft and the belief in witchcraft is still strong in almost every culture.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
That's amazing to me.
Well, our good friend Liu Igwe, who I had the pleasure of meeting finally in person at the last TAM, I sat with him and he's been doing excellent work in Africa.
Missed him. I'm so disappointed.
Oh, I think he's going to be back next year. So yeah. So basically, again, in order to really understand the genesis of the Popo Bawa and its nature, you have to sort of understand the sociocultural and religious aspects to it. And again, that includes both being from a Muslim area and also a belief in witchcraft and things like that. And so. So when you dig a little bit below the surface and once you sort of get past the idea that this is somehow some sort of actual real creature and there must be more to it, a more sort of symbolic version of it. You find that it's most people believe that it's a genie, a magical creature that was created or summoned by a warlock and then it escaped. And of course, that's a very common theme throughout folklore. You see that in the Jewish golem, for example, or Frankenstein's monster, where you have a scientist or just a magician or warlock summoning or creating or giving life to a creature, and that it sort of then escapes the bounds of its master and goes off and does harm. And many people believe that that's what the Popo Bawa is. And so, go ahead.
Yeah. Didn't you say in your article, I shouldn't have interjected, should let you finish, but didn't you say in your article that there was a sort of element of humor to the Popo Bawa as well, that there was, that it's such a sort of ludicrous creature, and that these stories, a lot of them have come up to sort of appease tourists and scare tourists, and that not many people really believe in it.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the interesting things about it, is that if you, and again, this sort of goes back to has echoes of my Chupacabra investigation. When I first was reading about the Popo Bawa, when I was first reading about the Chupacabra, all the literature seemed to suggest that the people on these islands, that is both Puerto Rico and Zanzibar, were just filled with people who were terrified of this creature. That was, this thing that was, causing mass hysteria and, this and that and the other, and armed mobs and whatever else. And what I found in both cases was that it absolutely was an element of widespread fear and panic, and in some cases mass hysteria. But overall, they weren't taken seriously. You know, they're just not there. In many cases, for example, they were treated as a joke. To this day in Puerto Rico, many places in Puerto Rico, you know, no one really takes the chupacabra seriously. They just think, oh, it's this sort of manufactured thing. In other more rural areas, they take it very seriously. Same thing with Zanzibar and the Popobawa. But I found that – so that was sort of one of the first surprises because, again, if you watch the Destination Truth show and if you read the little snippets on the Popobawa and various cryptozoological books, you sort of get the impression that the belief in this is widespread. And that's not true at all. Knowledge of it is widespread. Many people, you know, almost everybody that I asked had heard of the Popobawa. And most of them sort of nodded with a smile and said, yeah, whatever. I didn't get this, you know, sudden, you know, draining of, you know, blood in the face and this cowering. But nonetheless, you know, when I was in Zanzibar, I did manage to speak to several people who did believe in the Popobawa, including, again, one artist who I commissioned a sketch, a painting of it. And so I interviewed him and asked him what he thought about it. And I had other interviews as well. But it's certainly safe to say
that. Why did they believe?
Well, they primarily they believed because the old friend of a friend story, the old urban legend thing. Primarily they believed because, you know, their brother or the cousin or their brother's cousin or somebody, it happened to them. And it's that, you know, it bounced around, you know, friend of a friend telephone story. So they're very serious about it. At least they were to me. I do have to admit that it is difficult being a white Westerner to go to a place like Zanzibar and to get the locals to tell you about these things, because in some cases these are really deeply held beliefs. Even if they think they're a joke, they're, you know, it's like if you go into the deep south and, you know, you walk into a bar and say, anybody here want to tell me about racism? You know, you're not necessarily going to get welcomed with open arms. And so I certainly can't pretend that I, you know, that I got totally around that. I did make good friends with several of the Zanzibaris, and I do think I got pretty good information. I suspect that when Josh Gates and his Discovery Destination Truth team showed up, when I was watching the show, I could almost see the people he's interviewing sort of giggling, just thinking, "Wow, this sucker's buying everything that we're saying." So,
yeah.
So there is an element of sort of you know, needing to be careful about your informants in a case like this.
Were you able to find any first person like victims of the creature?
I was not, I was able to find several references to those sorts of cases. There were, off the top of my head, I think I found maybe three or four or five in the literature, people who were interviewed elsewhere. I personally couldn't find anybody who you know, was a first person. Again, it was always like, you know, a mate of mine, you know, heard about it from somebody else. The other angle that I took on that, because I was unable to find any first person accounts, was the only hard evidence that I could, you know, that I could even possibly try to track down, was that there were a few reports, primarily in a book called the Encyclopedia of Cryptozoology by Michael Newton. In the entry on Popobawa, Newton suggests that the Popobawa must be real in the entry on the Popobawa, Newton suggests that the Popobawa must be real because Zanzibar's main hospital treated numerous alleged Popobawa victims. Mm-hmm. So again, I had, because I'd done my research and preparation, I had photocopies of this material with me in Zanzibar, and so I could, you know, track it down and try to follow up on these things. And so this is intriguing. I'm like, okay, well, hold on here. This is, you know, if there are people who are actually being attacked and there are, you know, visible, actual, tangible bruises and, you know, maybe even rape kits, I don't know, of you know, Popobawa victims, then that's something to go on. And so I actually went to the main hospital in Zanzibar, which is called the Zanzibar Medical Group. And I talked to interviewed a guy named I interviewed Dr. Omar Saleh Omar, who's the main physician there. And I asked him, have you or anybody else treated Popobawa victims? And he just laughed. It was almost like saying, you know.
You didn't speak to the right person,
clearly. Yeah, clearly I didn't speak to the right person, right? It's almost like, yeah, I say, you know, have you treated anybody that was beaten up by Santa Claus? No.
You sounded nervous there, Blake.
No particular reason.
Blake's a little scared.
I don't like to be beat with a sack of toys. That's the.
There you go. Yeah. But so that was the so again, this was another case of where an ostensibly, you know, valid lead sort of evaporated. You know, I mean, we've all seen this over and over in the both not only in the cryptozoological literature, but in the paranormal as well, where there's these sort of, you know, just these wild statements and assertions and claims that you know, if you actually go to the original sources, have no basis at all. So after I was told pretty clearly that you know, nobody had ever come in with Popobawa, you know, attacks, then that pretty much nailed it for me there. So then the question then became, well then what are we talking about here? And so at that point, the first thing I went to was the psychological explanation. And Joe Nickel, in his book Tracking the Man Beast and elsewhere, did a fairly cursory and superficial examination of the Popobawa. And he talks about how he was given an article on the Popobawa. I think it was in 1995. It was maybe even the same article that I read. And he said that he read a few paragraphs and declared that he'd solved it. And he said that, I'm looking at his book, he says, quote, "I only needed to recall some of my earlier research to realize that the Popobawa is essentially a Zanzibaran version of the physiological and psychological phenomena known as waking dreams." End quote. So he's basically saying that essentially the Popobawa is nothing more than a waking dream. And as we all know, that's when, you know, either you're going into sleep or coming out of sleep and you have, you know, the succubus, you know, feeling of, you know, being pressure on the chest and you're immobile and things like that. And of course, this also ties in with alien abductions and feelings like that, you know, things are going on. I think there's an element of truth to that, but
it sounds like one explanation.
Yeah, I mean,
it sounds to me like applying a plausible explanation to something that an even more plausible explanation might just be folklore.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of my take on it. And so rather than just sort of reading an article and deciding that I'd solved the case, I figured that I would sort of look into it more deeply. And what I realized was that, that again, the psychological explanation of, you know, the waking dream is certainly an element to it, but it doesn't explain, doesn't really fully explain the Popobawa sightings. For example, it doesn't explain the pattern of the attacks. Which is very unique. The patterns don't occur randomly. The Popobawa attacks tend to occur primarily just before, during, and after elections. Now, if these were simply waking dreams, then you would expect that they would occur more or less at random. People have waking dreams. There's no reason to assume that people would have more or more vivid waking dreams, or certainly waking dreams about the Popobawa specifically, just before, during, or after an election.
So why is that? Because I read about that on Wikipedia.
Well, yeah, it's. Why is there a connection to the elections?
To the elections, yeah. Because it says here victims argue that the Popobawa is apolitical.
Yeah, I think that the basic answer is that. Is that the Popobawa is essentially, in many ways, a folkloric myth that's been co-opted as a tool of social control, basically a political tool. And again, not to keep going back to the Chupacabra, but there's actually quite a few parallels here. The Chupacabra was also co-opted as a political tool in Puerto Rico by the mayor of the capital of Puerto Rico in San Juan, Kimo Soto, who organized these expeditions to go and track down the Chupacabra and you know, and defeat it, you know, with all our might and guns and everything else. And Kimo Soto, who, as I recall, is actually still the mayor there, he very much turned it into a political tool where he was sort of framing himself in the public's mind as, you know, the defender of Puerto Ricans against this evil vampiric blah 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 blah. And again, that was very much the case also with the Zanzibari demon Popobawa, where you had these rival political parties who were essentially using the Popobawa for their own purposes. For example, I've researched Zanzibari politics, and it's far too complicated to go into. Basically, you have these sort of rival parties, and you know they're what we would consider to be, you know, sort of low level elections, but there it's a very big thing. And you had these rival political parties, and what was actually happening was that rival parties would say, well, for example, the ruling party would try and prevent election fraud by telling people, if you commit election fraud, the Popobawa will attack you. There will be consequences. And vice versa, the people are saying, well, if you don't vote for our candidate, the Popobawa will you know, attack you and again sodomize you and things like that. Now, inherent in that assumption, if you think about it, is the idea that the Popobawa is under some control or direction of the political parties. And that actually makes sense if you remember the notion of genies, genies being controlled by warlocks or witches. Again, the belief of which is widespread throughout Zanzibar and East Africa. So to many people in Zanzibar and elsewhere, the notion that high-level officials might be connected to witches, warlocks, witch doctors, you know, people with not political power, but, you know, magical power, is very plausible. Absolutely. And in fact, you see that throughout Africa.
And that makes me want to ask as well, is the Popobawa in any way linked to misfortune or seen to be the cause of natural disasters and things like that?
If you're a victim, it's pretty disastrous.
Outside of that, on a national scale, I'm wondering of other ties to politics and protection of people.
Right. Well, it's in many ways, it's again, I sort of tie it more into the element of social control. And again, we see this with other monsters. You see this with the Lake Champlain monster, Champ. You know, if you don't behave, parents tell their kids, we're going to push you in the lake and Champ will eat you. Or, you know, the Boggy Creek or Bigfoot, you know, don't go in the woods, you know, whatever. Chupacabra. So there's always this interesting element of social control. In the case of the Popobawa, it's interesting because even though its nature is said to be that of a genie, which is often characterized by misfortune, as we mean. I remember our excellent interview with Robert Liebling, who wrote one of my favorite books, Legend of the Fire Spirits, on genies and djinn. I think we interviewed him last year. Just a fascinating, fascinating study, and I remember just being just blown away by the research in his book on genies and djinn. And from that, I was. You know, learning and remembering that oftentimes genies and djinn are blamed for small misfortunes, peccadilloes, even acting out, even infidelity. People will say, you know, don't blame me. You know, I was possessed. This is why I did that.
Which we find in this culture as well.
Absolutely. And what I find interesting is that, again, you see this Popobawa being used by rival political parties for their own ends. And in many ways, I mean, it's exactly parallel to American politics. American politics, I mean, seriously, think about it. I mean, American politics has virtually identical mythical boogeyman. There's, you know, Sarah Palin's death panels, you know, where she was talking about Obama was going to kill everyone's grandmother. You know, there was the 1980s racist ads starring Willie Horton that Republicans used to scare voters into thinking that if they didn't vote Republican, that these violent black men were going to be raping, young, innocent white daughters. Or even, you know, the most obvious example is George Bush and Saddam Hussein. Hussein was the perfect boogeyman because he had the mythical weapons of mass destruction. And if you don't do what I tell you to do, Hussein's WMDs will get you. And of course, that wasn't true either.
Yeah, it's easy for us to ignore the parallels, but I can see them. Yeah,
exactly.
The way people deal with monster claims and also with UFO claims it's so easy to take these. I want to go back to this thing about the sleep paralysis. It's so easy to say, here's a story, and I'm listening to the symptoms or the clues or the facts that are being presented. And I can say, oh, well, now, okay, so yeah, I could see where you might think it's a monster that does these things, but it also could be X, Y, or Z. You know, here's these very mundane reasons you might have the same experience. But that's not really the same as actually doing the research to see who was the first victim. You know, where's case zero? You know, can I talk to these victims? You know, who were the witnesses? You know, and so actually getting on the ground and going out to try to look takes you a lot further along, I think, than, you know, armchair skepticism. But that starting point of, you know, what is another plausible explanation is as far as a lot of skeptics get. And so I think it's really, really, really important to not stop there and to actually take it further. Because if you don't, then if it comes out later that there's better evidence that something really did happen, then everything you've done looks like a armchair debunking and nothing at all like an actual investigation. So I just want to kind of...
Yeah, I think another important point is to hedge and say this is a possible explanation. This is not the ultimate or only explanation, or not to say you've solved something.
Good point. Good point. Yeah.
To offer it up as a potential explanation.
Sure. I mean, and again, with the case of the hallucinations and the waking dreams, again, there's clearly an element of the sort of the succubus, the, you know, the sleep paralysis, people feeling. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, there's a really good book called The Terror That Comes in the Night by David Hufford, who's a folklorist. And he does a really good in-depth analysis of the old hag phenomena, which is essentially a variation of the succubus and all that. And he talks about how, you know, essentially the you know, this phenomena is, it's inherent in the human mind. I mean, that's, we all experience it. And so it would actually be remarkable if Muslims did not have some variant of it, that sort of, you know, that was sort of crystallized into something like the Popobawa. And so, and for example, it also, the sleep paralysis doesn't really explain why, if it were a simple waking dream, why would the entity demand that that you know, its victims tell other people? You know, there's that, it doesn't explain that at all. And again, part of the answer to that is, again, it's because it's largely folklore. Yeah. It's a self-perpetuating mechanism.
I need to throw that out there too.
Effect.
I can't remember if we said this before on the air or on Monster Talk. But it's a really, if you want to be a skeptical investigator of any type, a great starting point, I'll just say that, a fantastic starting point is to familiarize yourself with urban legends and folklore, because you'll learn to recognize when a story that shows up in the news sounds just like something you've heard before.
Yeah, all the hallmarks.
Right. There's so many sort of tropes. In fact, I think within folklore, they have a numbering and naming mechanism for things that recur. But so many skeptics, motifs. Motifs. Thank you. I couldn't remember the word. There's these recurring motifs in folklore. And, you know, that's really, it's incumbent to get out and do some research and actually learn. And when I say that, like book learning, this is great. Go get a book and read, Jan Harald Brunvon, is a great, great place to start.
Jan Brunvon.
So
I think you're exactly right.
I'm kind of frustrated because I keep seeing so many skeptics on blogs and discussion groups and stuff. Well, they saw some lights in the air, so it's probably an airplane. You know that. Well, right. We don't even know if they really saw lights, right? So this is tricky.
No, you're exactly right, and I think that to my mind, it's a good example of a combination of the two. It's good research, you know, book learning, doing the, you know, finding out. Because, you know, to be honest with me, when I began looking into the Popobawa, as I said, there was almost no research. And to this day, I mean, my research was written up and published in as a cover article in 40 in Times magazine. I think it was November 2008. And to this day, my article remains, I think, one of, I don't know, one or two or three basically, you know, in-depth critical analyses of it. And this, you know, going on 5-6 years now. So there's literally not that much there. And so to my mind, that's all the more reason why it's good to, you know, to you can break fresh ground on this. You can do the research on it instead of just sort of sitting back and saying, oh, well, it's this or it's that. This is a good, you know, example to my mind of blending scholarship and research with, it, you know, obviously not everybody can, you know, up and visit Zanzibar on the drop of a hat, but I just happened to be there and I happened to know that I was going to be there and did the research. And so I took advantage of being there and doing that. And so it was sort of a combination of, yeah, of, you know, exploiting an opportunity to do it, but also being prepared. So that's,
yeah, well, another interesting, another interesting angle would be to look at individual cases, like actual, as Blake was saying earlier, firsthand experiences and, mm-hmm. and claims, and to investigate those to increase the amount of information that's out there about this creature.
Absolutely, absolutely, I was just going to wrap up with the on the thought in terms of the origins of the genie, because like, you know, I have to say, when I first began, you know, looking at the Popobawa, I knew something about genies, and I certainly knew that it was a Muslim area, but I hadn't done as much research as I done either when I did the investigation or certainly now in terms of the background on genies and Arabic folklore and things like that. And so once I realized that, again, it was to my mind, one of the keys to really getting into it was, instead of approaching it in terms of what is the Westerner's view of it, mm-hmm. what was important to me was, what is their view of it? It doesn't matter what I think it was. It doesn't matter what Josh Gates thinks it was or Joe Nick or whatever else. What matters is the people that live there. What does it mean to them? And mm-hmm. the answer to them was, you know, it's something that's controlling them, telling them what to vote for. And it's also something that is wrapped up not only in their, you know, derived from their belief in magic, but also from their religion, the, you know, Islam and the Quran. And it also makes sense when you look at it that way, because they do believe that Popobawa is inherently a genie, that, as I mentioned earlier, that the one of the things that it does is it especially threatens to rape skeptics. So those who
we doubt, should be living in fear of it.
Well, that's the thing. You know,
well,
those
not me.
Who doubt. Well, not you. You're probably safe. Well, sometimes it's women, you know. But
yeah, there's another question. Did it ever attack women?
I did come across one or two cases. There, it's pretty rare. I mean, it's primarily said to attack men. And again, that I think that also probably reflects the social status of men in Muslim countries. And so, anyway, just, you know, again, sort of what reinforced its origin in the Quran in Islam to me was, it makes sense that it would attack skeptics and doubters, because it's essentially following many of the Quran's tenets. You know, I've read the Quran, and it does talk about how you should, you know, you should attack unbelievers and you should not befriend them. There are also other passages that sort of, you know, refute that, but there, it is crystal clear that if you're looking for a source for something that is going to, you know, that is going to tell you to attack doubters and unbelievers, the Quran, it makes perfect sense that a genie that is derived from the Quran would crystallize and manifest itself in this skeptic raping bat demon ogre monster chameleon thing called the Popobawa.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Monster Talk. Today, Karen Stolzno and Blake Smith interviewed our co-host Ben Radford about his investigation of the winged rape monster of Zanzibar, the Popobawa. Monster Talk is supported by Skeptic Magazine and listeners like you. If you'd like to donate to our transcript project, please go to monstertalk.org and click the donate button. We have several new transcripts up, and they help us get new listeners, as well as making it easier to cite our show on Wikipedia. Hey, are you in the Atlanta area? Are you planning to attend DragonCon? Be sure to check out the Atlanta Skeptics annual Star Party. This year we'll be in a new venue in a really fun restaurant called Stats. The party will be hosted by the bad astronomer himself, Phil Plait, and Nicole Gugliucci. You'll get music from George Robb and Marion Call. And plus, Ben and I will be there too, so you might get puns. It's fun, it's educational, and the $60 ticket gets you some great food. Plus, it fights cancer in the memory of the astronomer Jeff Medkiff. I hope you can make it. Monster Talk theme music's by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you for listening.
Stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
All I will have to cut out are the bit about your mom and all my swallowing of phlegm. Yeah.
I'll leave that in. That adds ambiance too.
Jesus.
More ambiance.